When you need expert help and advice on issues affecting your business, NFU Cymru, we're here for you.
Farmers Guardian is proud to work alongside the Rock and Roll Farming Podcast. For all the latest news and features from across the ag industry, head to fginsight.com. You'll also find a wide variety of advice pieces to help you and your farming business flourish.
Want to get to know the people who produce the food that you eat? This is the place. Step this way and welcome to Rock and Roll Farming.
Hey everybody, and welcome to Rock and Roll Farming episode 127. I'm your host, Will Evans, and today I'm heading down to Gloucestershire to talk to James and Katie Allen. Hello to the both of you.
Hi, Will.
Hi, Will.
And hello to baby Jack as well, who's in the room too.
Yeah, he's got a bottle in his mouth at the moment, but he's waving.
And for those people listening, it is it's very early in the morning. We're recording this 7 o'clock in the morning on a Sunday, so I do appreciate you both doing this at this time of the day.
Yeah, no problem. We actually had to wake Jack up this morning for it, so it's not our normal time of the day, so see how we go.
So, James, you both live now just outside Cirencester, but you're from southeast of England, London area.
Yeah, originally. Technically, I was born actually in London, I think even within the sound of Bow Bells, technically, but my parents moved out to kind of southeast London, Kent way, when I was about 6 months old. Spent my whole childhood there up until I left to go to university.
Yeah, okay. Any family farming or any connections to farming at all?
So my parents don't farm, and my grandparents don't farm on either side, but the kind of the rest of the extended family do. Okay. So I've got relatives who, well, my uncle farmed for the Duchy of Cornwall down in Devon, had a whole bunch of sheep up on the moorland near the prison at Princetown.
Okay.
Very remote. You know, first person to get a phone call when someone broke out of the prison, type remote.
Yeah.
And that happened more than once, apparently. And others are farmers down in Kent, sort of doing orchards and various kind of things. I believe there's one of my relatives somewhere does fish farming. And then I've got my second cousin, who I spent a lot of time with as a kid. He now farms up on the borders in Scotland and does kind of, I think he's 1,000 sheep and 80, 90 odd cattle, really.
Okay, so is that, do you think, where your initial interest in farming came from?
I think for me, yeah, it has to be. I mean, I had a very traditional kind of childhood. So I went to school in southeast London, up in Catford. I was very kind of scientist, engineering type. So I did maths, physics, A-levels, and that just was the only route for me. But as a kid, my earliest and probably only memories really of really happy memories were I used to go and visit my, it's my mum's cousin. My mum's a child used to go up every year to go and help out at lambing. And we can continue that tradition.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah, as a kid, I used to go up, I'd say earliest memories really, going up, helping out on the farm at lambing time for 1 or 2 weeks every year. And then the earliest I was allowed, you know, I kind of begged my parents to put me on the train during the summer. So I used to start going up during the summer.
Yeah.
So they'd take me up to London, put me on a train at one end, and I'd get picked up at Newark at the other end. And all I had to do is remember to get out at Newark.
Yeah. And
I wouldn't do that with my kids now. Not at that age, I don't suppose.
Doesn't make a difference, yeah. I think.
And I used to do that, you know, learn how to drive. And, you know, I remember we were rounding up some sheep and all the parents are out in the field just kind of moving them through some gates, and Charlie, my second cousin, and I were sat in an old Renault van, one of these ones where the gear stick comes out of the dashboard.
Yeah.
And we decided to have a spin.
Of course you did.
Yeah, well, you did. What could go wrong? And that was it. That was the first time I remember driving. You know, with Charlie and I bouncing around this field while the parents are moving sheep around.
Yeah, and what about you, Casey? No farming anywhere in your family either?
No, not at all. I think my dad might have bred rabbits. And I think maybe I've got a grandfather that was a butcher in a city in Birmingham. But no, absolutely no connection to farming at all. So, yeah, completely. I think, you know, a lot of my family look at what we do and think we're crazy. We work really, really, really hard and make very, very little money from it. And they sort of, they just don't get it.
Yeah, I'm sure. So you're quite an urban childhood then.
Well, I guess so. I grew up in a village. I was born in Windsor.
Oh, okay.
And grew up in a sort of a village setting, and I was very lucky that we had an incredible garden. Mm-hmm. So I did spend a lot of time outdoors. Yeah, just lots of memories of the garden and being outdoors and being messy outdoors and things like that.
Yeah.
So I really liked the outdoors, but there was no, never any sort of connection to it for farming or a career or a future or anything like that. It was just, just enjoying the garden and being outdoors, really, I guess. Yeah. My parents weren't, they liked the water and boats. So we would spend, outdoors holidays, and being active was pretty a strong part of certainly my very, very early childhood. One, because I've got two older brothers, quite a bit older than me. Mm-hmm. But they're one of them in particular is massively into water sports, but not the sort of the down to earth outdoors sort of life that I lead now. Very different.
Yeah. Okay. And you didn't like school very much.
No, I didn't like school at all. I don't think there's actually really anything positive that I can pull out of school, particularly. I didn't really fit in, and sort of I was always a bit of a loner that sort of flitted around in between groups. I never really had a really good group of girlfriends. Didn't find that till I was a lot older. I sort of scraped into a quite an academic secondary school. But because I just scraped in, I was always at the bottom. I was always at the bottom of every class.
Yeah.
And, if I'd been in a more normal mainstream school, I probably would have been sat sort of in the middle. But I was always sort of scraping to keep up. So it just left me feeling a bit lacking in talent, I guess. And it didn't do my self-esteem much good.
Yeah, it's a similar story with me with my school career. So you left school as soon as you could then, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I stayed through 18, did A-levels, but, and I was really hardworking. I was hardworking at school. I got 9 Bs at GCSE. So, the subjects I wasn't great at, I pulled up but didn't really sort of feel that I excelled at anything. Whereas lots of kids, I think I was like the only child at school that didn't get at least 1 A. So it was just, it was things like that. There was just this feeling of not quite being good enough.
Yeah.
And I think that can have quite an impact. I certainly, when I left school, I had, a couple of A-levels. I think I did business studies A-level, and I think that was the best thing I ever did at school, because it just gave me such a really good grounding. I use it constantly, sod algebra. And all the other I had to do for GCC, my business studies A-level, I'd say there are things that I learned in that I apply on an almost daily basis now.
Okay, so how did you come to eventually set up a graphic design business?
Yeah, so when I left school at 18, I didn't want to go to uni because I didn't really know what I wanted to do. And I thought going and studying something for 3 years wasn't cheap. It was a bit of a waste of time. I would rather have done that when I knew, when there was a goal behind it. Mm-hmm. So I went and I tried to get a job but it was really hard because I didn't have any like proper office experience or anything like that. But I did eventually get a marketing administrator job. Because I'd really enjoyed the marketing module of the business studies spec. And funnily enough, it was at the company where James and I first met, all like what, 18 years ago?
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah,
a long time ago.
And that's also where I met my first husband as well. So I worked as a marketing administrator and then quickly got sort of bored of that role because it was, you know, I was obviously relatively good at it and reasonably bright, not necessarily sort of academically bright, but smart bright. And so wanted to, you know, be doing something else with a bit more responsibility. So sort of moved on and did those sorts of roles for a couple of years and realized how much I liked the design and creative aspect of it. Mm-hmm. I then decided to do a study in like the evenings and part time to qualify as a graphic designer. And then I set my own business up. I think because both my parents were self-made entrepreneurs, setting my own business up was just sort of like the logical thing to do.
Yeah.
You know, it was just like that logical, that's what you do, you know. Yeah. It wasn't a sort of a scary, oh, should I, shouldn't I? Obviously, at that age as well, I didn't have a mortgage or children or big scary responsibilities. It's an ideal time to be, you know, making brave steps. So I did a degree and set my small little graphic design business up.
We're going to take a short ad break now to talk about agricultural weighing specialist Griffith Elder. Griffith Elder specialise in agriculture with their weighing equipment. They design, manufacture here in the UK and supply weighbridges, portable weigh beams, multi-axle weighbridges and a host of other weighing equipment for weighing on the farm. The scales are a great way to know how much you've taken from the field and keep track what you have coming in and going out. The portable weigh beams are incredibly easy to install, so no need for any groundworks and can be placed straight in the yard or moved from store to store as and when you need. All of their scales come with an extensive range of recording equipment options and farm management software. And one very popular piece of kit is their cab fob system, which enables the driver to record the weight of their load without having to leave the comfort of the cab. Built to last for decades, Griffith Elder pride themselves in making simple to install, easy to operate and proven longevity weighing equipment for all their products.
Okay, so what kind of things were you doing?
So I specialised in working for really small businesses because I wanted to give small businesses access to really good quality graphic design and marketing, which I think a lot of small businesses struggle to find the budget for. Mm-hmm. So that was the ethos behind it. And because I was very rural, it was natural that I found, you know, a lot of like rural based businesses. I also joined an enterprise called Wire. I don't know if you've heard of it. It stands for Women in Rural Enterprise.
Yeah.
And it was a fantastic and still is a sort of a networking opportunity for sort of meeting like-minded female entrepreneurs all based in the countryside. And it gave me also access to a really fantastic customer base. And I worked with a couple of farm diversification businesses. One was a farm in Leicestershire that was making their own cheeses.
Okay.
And another I remember was a farm near Lichfield, because at the time I was based in Warwickshire, that was making, she was making homemade puddings out of her converted barn. So I was sort of designing their branding and packaging and exhibition materials and things like that. And I loved it. I loved going to these farms and seeing what they were doing and sitting around the kitchen table in the farmhouse You know, I can remember the cheese company that they offered me a cup of tea when I sat down, and the husband had just walked in from milking the cows, and he had this great big jug of their own milk. And it was just, for me, it was, that was just like, wow, that's amazing. You know, you've got your own milk and you're making this cheese, and, you know, you're just being so resourceful with what you've got. And it was just, I don't know, I loved it. And was really interested in working with those kinds of businesses, farms that were diversifying.
Okay, all right then. And James, you did a civil engineering degree.
Yeah, I really didn't know what I wanted to do after A-levels. As I say, you know, I did a fairly traditional maths, physics, chemistry. And I ended up, the way I did civil engineering, was I liked building stuff, you know, pretty much. What caused me to do civil engineering? Back in those days, and I don't suppose they do it now, is there's a book called the UCAS book, which was a list of all the universities and courses you could do. I went through the index at the back and just crossed everything out that I couldn't do. So anything to do with languages just went straight. And I ended up pretty much with civil engineering, really. I vaguely remember there were some kind of agricultural type things that were probably on the list of five things that I hadn't crossed out. But it just, you know, because the way I'd grown up through kind of London and, you know, not pushed by parents and school, but there kind of wasn't an open option. So it just never occurred to me it was actually something I could do. So I ended up doing civil engineering and did that up at Nottingham, which was good. I mean, thoroughly enjoyed it. But it was more the social life I enjoyed rather than the academic stuff, really.
Yeah, I'm sure Nottingham was a fun place to go to university.
Yeah, it was. I mean, well, the reason I chose Nottingham for two reasons. One was, my second cousin, you know, they were at Newark. So, you know, I had fond memories of the area, and I could pop out occasionally, probably once a term, I'd pop out over once on a Sunday to go and see great Auntie Mabel and get a roast dinner. Well, that was one reason. The other reason was just because of it was, you know, at the time it was reputed to be the best university to go to from a social point of view.
And
I think the women to men ratio was quite high as well, probably.
Yes, famously true.
Like decision making rather than actually kind of it's a good academic course. It was for all the wrong reasons, but that was good. I enjoyed it.
Yeah, okay. So where did you go from there? Where did you end up working after you did your degree?
Oh, I really didn't know what I wanted to do. And I kind of, one of the things I did enjoy in the course was the kind of water engineering. So basically because we messed around with big tanks of water more than anything else. And when you compare that to solid mechanics, which might be 2 hours discussing the forces on a cube of metal, you know, it was just completely different world. So I ended up, I went up and did some research on ocean waves up in Edinburgh. So we had a big wave tank, which is a large swimming pool, basically, and we created waves in that and did testing of models. And we also, my actual research was collecting ocean waves from an oil rig in the North Sea and analysing that data and basically looking, without going into too much detail, which bores people. It's a lot funny. how waves group together, and if they, under certain circumstances, they can group together and make very, very big waves, which damage all rigs and things like that. You know, you end up with a 30-meter wave in the North Sea. We recorded a 30-meter wave in the North Sea, and I still can't comprehend how big that actually is. But we got a phone call from the oil rig just after New Year, saying, "Look, did a big wave come through a couple of days back?" And we all kind of looked at the data and went, yeah, it's like a 30-odd metre wave. And he said, oh, no, it's done a bit of damage. We'll send you some photographs. And it, you know, blown hole, their decking, sheet steel of, you know, goodness knows how many inches thick. It just torn it apart like butter. So, that was the research I did. And that kind of went on for 3.5 years until funding ran out. And I kind of, again, was a bit stuck what to do. So I decided rather than actually work to go traveling for 6 months to see if they could sort the funding out while I was away, and then just kind of disappeared overseas for a while just to get away from the world.
Yeah, okay. So where did you go?
I spent a month in Indonesia doing the kind of traditional backpacker traveling type thing, which was, you know, a great experience. You know, it's I suspect Indonesia has changed in 20 years or whatever it is since I did that. But it was, you know, it was as cheap as anything, and you literally just got on a train or a bus or whatever and went from place to place and crossed into different islands. And I did a bit of diving. I had learned to do some diving in Scotland. And so I then did diving out in Indonesia for a week off one of these small little islands.
I bet that was different, Scotland to Indonesia.
I learned to dive off Oban. So it was dry suit weather,
and
there was snow on the ground.
Oh my god!
Scuba diving, so you have to be able to take your mask off underwater.
Yeah,
and the cold, I mean, literally.
James doesn't like the cold. He doesn't like the cold, especially cold water.
Cold water in particular, and that was harsh. But as Katie said, the next time I was diving was in a place called the Gili Isles, which in Indonesia, which, you know, I mean, it was as hot as you like, and the water was, you know, as warm as a bath, with all the coral reef and sharks and, you know, all that sort of thing. So, yeah, it was completely different.
I'll put it. So while you were travelling, did you grow a ponytail or get a dodgy tattoo or anything like that?
That's far too sensible.
It's not my style at all. The month was traveling was fine, and it was, you know, I really enjoyed it. But I then kind of moved on to Australia, New Zealand, which was pretty typical at the time, and actually worked for most of that. Because I'm not very good at the just kind of thumbing around and being the kind of, you know, ponytail, let's go and find a tattoo type person. I need to be busy. I need to be doing stuff.
Yeah.
And so I worked for 2 months in Australia and then 3 months in New Zealand, doing fun stuff. It wasn't office stuff. And then kind of did Fiji for a couple of weeks in my home.
Yeah, okay. It must have been great, though, travelling around Australia and New Zealand, and must have had a good time.
Yeah, I mean, I did, no doubt about it. It's funny, it's one of those things, you know, you meet anyone that goes travelling, and they say, oh, best time of your life, and, you know, and it's great. There is a lot of time when you sat around bored, kind of, you know, because you're not doing anything. And I think Indonesia, there was a certain amount of that. But as I say, I worked when I was in New Zealand and Australia, just because I'm not very good at just sitting around, just kind of waiting for the world to go. And, you know, in Australia, for example, I wanted to do some hang gliding. So I kind of learned to hang glide, which is a kind of 1 week course. And I just stuck around, and I spent 2 months working basically as a hang gliding instructor, because the actual instructor just wanted to sit on the beach and get a suntan. It's typical Aussie bloke, used to go out drinking in the evening, and actually during the day just wanted to sit on the beach. And because I'm quite good at kind of coaching type stuff, I ended up teaching people how to hang glide for 2 months, which was great. That was fun.
It's scary. That's only a week's course. Great, but I'm qualified for that.
Yeah, all you've got to do is learn how to land. Because you kind of go off. There was a 200-300-foot cliff on the beach, and we used to go off that. I mean, you started on the beach at low level.
Yeah.
By the end of the week, the aim was you'd go off this 200-foot cliff, and it literally was kind of run, launch, and don't worry about it particularly until you get near the ground, and that's the bit you've been training for. Experience, but that one's great. I mean, by the end of 2 months, you know, I was flying at 2,000-3,000 feet. I could see out to this, you know, it was up in Cairns in Australia. I could see out towards the Great Barrier Reef. You know, there were eagles kind of flying below you. It's quite an experience. So that was good fun. And then I went to New Zealand, and I did rugby coaching. I was coaching up Auckland Rugby Union for 3 months.
Okay, so how did you end up in software development? It's quite a big change.
Good question.
Yeah. I got back from a traveling, and I went back to the university. I went up to my supervisor and said, great, you sorted the funding out? And his literally the response he said, oh, you're back, are you? And I went, yeah. how's the funding thing going? Ah, yes, I need to get that sorted. Okay. And bear in mind, I've been away 6 months. The writing was on the wall a bit. And within the week, I walked into the office and then on the desk was this job advert. No comment, no nothing, but I took it as a bit of a subtle hint. And so I applied for the job. Was down in Oxfordshire doing model testing on kind of, again, similar stuff that I was doing, but commercial in a big wave tank. I did that for 3-4 years. And after that time, I mean, I spent a lot of that time, you know, writing data analysis software, so nothing terribly exciting. The job was good fun, you know. We used to sit on a big swimming pool, basically, and watch boats bob up and down with lasers on them and things like that. But after 4 years of doing that, I kind of got bored.
Yeah.
So long you can sit and watch, you know, a three-meter model of a boat bobbing up and down on water.
Yeah.
And we've done some interesting, you know, we used to do model testing of rivers, and there was a ocean boat simulator, you know, one of these big wraparound screens. And so it was fun, but it wasn't forever kind of thing. And I realized that actually I really enjoyed writing the software. And so I sent out, oh, God knows how many kind of letters and CVs saying, I haven't really done much software stuff, but, and there was this company that wrote back and said, come have a chat. Went and had a chat, and they said, yeah, sure, yeah, go for it. But obviously we'll have to start you on a graduate salary. And, you know, bearing in mind by this time, I was probably coming close to 28, probably 27, 28. Uh-huh. And I went, sure, no, fine, whatever. And I said, how much? And he told me how much, and it was a pay rise. So, oh, great, you know, engineering sucks. I'm into software. And I ended up, you know, well, I still do it. It's still my day job. I don't write code anymore. You know, I still really enjoy it. I love making software work for people. And where we do education software, so it's for national exams, GCSEs and A-levels type exams. It's quite complex, so it really pushes my brain at times. But yeah, no, I still enjoy it.
Yeah, okay. So had you always been a sort of computer tech kind of nerd or not?
I'll let you get away with the word nerd because
I'm a nerd as well, so
yeah a little bit. I mean, the truth be told, I'm not brilliant at actually the nerdy bit. So our network at home doesn't work terribly well, for example, and I'm not great at it.
That's time, though.
It is partly. Well,
the reason the network at home doesn't work very well is because you don't have the time to sort it.
Well, it's also because I don't understand it. So I probably haven't owned up to it.
No, I don't think you have.
I mean, the interesting thing is, when I was at school, I had no idea what I wanted to do. I struggled a lot with dyslexia. And as part of that, I went for one of these career test things where you sit and answer a whole bunch of ridiculous questions, and they turned around and said, you need to be a doctor. And I did that, and it was, I mean, computers were completely different then. A lot of your audience won't realize how different they were. I mean, the internet just didn't exist. You know, it was ZX Spectrum and the BBC Basic was about and things like that. And this report came back, and I found it a couple of years ago, and it said, you know, you ought to get into computers. And at the time, I didn't really know what a computer was. But, you know, ironically, the guy was right. And, you know, my dad bought a computer when we were a kid, and I wanted a ZX Spectrum, and he wouldn't buy one because he didn't think it was the right computer. And he bought, I think it was a Dragon 32, and they went bust a month later. So I didn't really get into it until university. And it was in my final year. And I was doing job applications because I thought I ought to get a job. And I went into the computer department and said, look, you know, I need to get a job. I need to write a CV. How do I use a computer? And they sat me down in front of it and showed me a bit of software for writing. I can't even remember what it was now. And I, after a day of getting really frustrated, but kind of seeing the value of it, I turned around and said, I just need to buy one of these things. And I just went and bought a computer, sat it at my desk at home, and kind of learned from there, really. And it was when I was doing research. You know, I had 3.5 years of analyzing data. We didn't have an awful lot of data to analyze for various reasons. So I ended up playing on computers, taught myself to touch type because why not? Mm-hmm. And I learned it's the logic that appeals to me. Mm-hmm. Struggle with dyslexia. People who are dyslexic often find logic quite simple.
Yeah.
There's quite a lot of people in my industry who are dyslexic.
Is that right?
It's kind of just the way your brain works. Yeah. You know, my brain's very crap at language, but it's very good at logical stuff. And again, being a bloke, it's kind of fairly, you know, stereotypical that, you know, I think logically rather than emotionally, which causes issues at times. And I just kind of fell into it, really. So I was never brilliant at it, but what I found I was quite good at was, you know, working with other people and getting other people to be brilliant at it. You know, back to the coaching thing, you know, actually, yeah. I'm a better coach than I am a doer. You know, I was a far better rugby coach than I ever was a player.
So you settled into life as a software developer. How did you get from there to keeping a number of rare breed pigs?
I don't know. They didn't just turn up.
No.
It was one of those things. I can't remember why, but I turned around to my first wife and I said, "I fancy pigs." And she just said, "Okay." And I went, "Yeah, I know, but I can't." And she said, "Well, why not?" And I said, "I don't know. I can't think for good reason." And I think I was bought for my birthday a how to keep a pig for the day course. I got back and I said, obviously, we don't have any land. You know, there's nothing. And you don't need much land for pigs. So I ended up, well, that's not going to stop me. So I leafleted the village. And I put leaflets all around the village. Anybody got a bit of land, wanted to do a joint enterprise, just have a few pigs. And family came knocking on the door and said, "Go on then, we've got a horse paddock, we've got a corner we don't want, we're up for that." So I just went and bought some and kind of went from there, really. I didn't have many, and originally it was just intended as a bit of a fun thing to do. I had young kids at the time, so Jenny, my oldest daughter, she'd have been, she'd have been six, I would reckon. And I thought it's a fun thing for her to do, but also it's a good way of actually understanding where food comes from. Because, you know, a lot of kids these days, you know, it comes from the supermarket wrapped in cling film. Whereas actually, you know, I could say, well, this is a pig, and, you know, I had a conversation with Jenny day one before we even bought them. You know, it's a meat, it's not a pet, it's a meat, and we're going to eat it. That's the deal. And, you know, I had that conversation with the 6-year-old, which was great to be able to talk to her about where meat comes from. And we used to, you know, we kept them for 6-8 months and put a couple in the freezer and sold to a few local pubs. And it just kind of, you know, that's just what I did for however many years, 5-6 years.
So, Katie, how did you get from running your own business, and you said you had some contact with some farming businesses. How did you get there into farming in your own right?
I guess around the time that I was setting, you know, getting this graphic design business off the ground and meeting these sort of fantastic real businesses, I had a skin reaction to an item of clothing I'd bought, and went on the internet, you know, to do a bit of research, just try and find out, you know, what was going on, what I directed to, and was horrified to find out the chemicals that are sort of used in the textiles industry, even sort of at the, obviously throughout the process, but even at like the finishing stage, to almost preserve the clothes so that they don't wrinkle and get mildew while they're being shipped and stored around. Which is why, you know, now whenever I buy any new clothes, I always pre-wash it before it goes into anybody's, you know, wardrobe or anything like that. And it was quite a shock, I think, sort of having had that my body having had that reaction, and then sort of learning potentially why. And I think it just sort of opened a bit of a floodgate, and it sort of made me think, well, if that's on my clothes, what's in my food, and what's in the cream that I put on my skin and on my face every day? And it just really sort of made me completely reevaluate all of these different things. And I wanted to learn a little bit more, therefore, about how these things were made, particularly food. I looked into organic cotton production, you know, skincare products that use less chemicals, and sort of started thinking a lot more about, you know, I wanted some chickens and I wanted to grow a few veggies, and it just connected me a lot more with the supply chain of all the things that we're eating. And I guess I wanted to be able to make decisions about what I was eating and wearing, and, you know, particularly the eating. I think the eating one's the easier one to fix. I think obviously with the clothes and skincare products, you're very limited to just what's available, sure, particularly clothing. And certainly 10 or 15 years ago as well, when this sort of happened. But I think it was certainly the food aspect was something I really saw an area that I could really learn more about, make a difference about. And I think because I'd always loved being outside, playing in the garden as well, it all sort of started, and we were living rurally, so I was always out walking the dog and walking through the fields and seeing the crops growing, and it was all starting to connect, I guess, for me. So I went on to a smallholder course at Warwickshire Agricultural College. It was just an 8-week course in the evenings, and each evening we covered a different topic. So one week it was sheep, one week it was pigs, beekeeping. It was, you know, was quite, you know, very sort of low level. It was just literally touching on all these different aspects. There was an element of practical work. I think they did show us how to turn a sheep. And I think that's like the only time I've ever had anyone ever show me how to turn a sheep. Although James also, because from his childhood as well, obviously James showed me a different way, actually, which I would say is potentially a lot easier and which I use now. But it was quite classroom based, but it just made me thirsty for more knowledge. I wanted to know more. I just loved it. I was intrigued. I bought loads of books. I went on at the time I was living sort of in the Cotswolds, but the other side of the Cotswolds, and I went on a Dalesford, the organic farm have run these great workshops, or they certainly were back then running these really fantastic workshops, and I went on one which was run by the head farmer there, Richard Smith, and it was all about how to run an organic smallholding, and he was so inspiring. And I left there just knowing that I had to farm. You know, this was what I wanted to do. And sort of, you know, at the time I had a house with a small sort of market garden out the back with some chickens, and just knew I wanted more. You know, I thought it would only ever be a couple of acres. Have a few sheep, you know, produce enough produce for the family, I guess, was where I was at and what I was thinking. And it was just something I just really wanted to do. And I'm pretty determined.
So, no comment.
So that was that, really, I guess. About a similar time that whilst this was all going on and you know, this was all I was learning and getting more passionate about this, I then eventually with my ex-husband got to a place where he had to make a career change, and we sort of were, what are we going to do? You know, we had Izzy, I had my first daughter at the time, who was about three years old, and we decided to buy a small holding on the North Cornwall coast. It was about 20 acres. It had holiday cottages with it and a campsite. And I had the idea of doing glamping with yurts on this campsite. And I wanted to do a farm shop and sell our own produce to all the guests and run this really green, eco-focused holiday destination. Mm-hmm. And we went for it. And it was extremely hard to secure the farm. It was at the time when the banks had just had their big crash and they weren't really lending much money.
Yeah.
And at the time, I think we had to put together a really kick-ass business plan. And at the time, I think we represented that the month that we were our mortgage was agreed represented something like half of all of Lloyds Bank's lending that month.
Wow.
Because they were lending so little.
Okay.
And we were also after quite a big mortgage. But you would never have imagined that that was half of their lending for that month.
Yeah.
You know? So that was something I was quite proud of, that we'd managed to pull this business plan together and convince this bank to lend us all this money to follow this dream. And we did really well. You know, we doubled the income that the, because it was, so we bought it, the holiday cottages were ticking along at the time. They did had the holiday cottages there, but you know, we redecorated them, obviously, with what we added to the small holding. We added a lot of value to what people were coming for, to stay for, and the yurts as well. And we got pigs, we sold our own pork, I built this massive market garden so guests could turn up and they could have a basket of fresh veggies, they could have, you know, sausage and bacon and eggs for their breakfast. I bought lots of other local supplies in, found a fantastic bakery to bring in, you know, that we got fresh bread for. And in the holidays, when there were lots of kids on site, I'd take them around, introduce them to the pigs. They could collect the eggs from the chickens and sort of learn about what we were doing there. And I absolutely loved it. I really loved it. We converted the farm to organic as well with the Soil Association.
Okay.
And I loved it. It was home. It was, I was doing everything I wanted. That's where I bought my first sheep as well. And I did, you know, it was, I wanted to do something with their wool.
Yeah.
That was part of why I bought sheep. It all sort of really, really, I was really able to start putting into practice a lot of the things I spent the previous 5 years reading about and learning about and wanting to do.
Obviously it came naturally to you. Did you enjoy having guests stay with you on the holding then?
So I think that was probably what I was most worried about.
Yeah, because it's a big thing, that, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. And we've got, you know, this is our home. It felt a bit like heaven, and I loved it. And I thought, gosh, I was particularly worried about the holidays because I thought that's when it was all kids and families. And, you know, we had probably 8 or 9, like, holiday units. So we had, like, you know, 8 or 9, one of them was quite big, so put, you know, 10 families on site. So I was nervous about how that was going to be, but actually it turned out to be my favorite time because all the kids, it didn't matter where they were from, all were so interested in the animals and they were so interested in what we were doing and loved coming around with me and, you know, loved collecting the eggs and seeing the pigs, and it was lovely. They were so interested, and because they were interested and I was sharing information with them, they thought I was amazing. They thought I was so they, you know, they were fantastically behaved, and it was just wonderful. It actually ended up being my probably my favorite times of the year because of this, you know, being able to share this with people who were so interested and equally passionate. And also, to be fair, during the day, they all went off to the beach, and, you know, it was only in the evenings that really people were about.
Yeah.
So actually it wasn't like this continual, you know, 24/7 dealing with people and problems and complaints, and everyone was pretty happy.
Yeah.
You know,
was there any challenging guests, any weird stories?
I did have somebody once that came that was genuinely convinced aliens existed. And literally the first thing he started talking to me about was UFOs and aliens and did I believe? And of course he'd seen this. And it was literally like the first thing he said to me. So So that was a little bit alarming, but you know, not what that I believe or have a strong opinion neither way, but it was just more that was his first thing this that he wanted to share with me. generally everybody was pretty normal.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So I guess it sounds like you were both very settled in your lives and careers, but as you've both mentioned, ex partners, and now you guys are married, obviously, second time around for both of you. How did you come to find each other again?
Facebook.
Yeah, well, it was. When I did a career change, the company, software company I went to, Katie actually worked there. She was in the marketing department. I mean, it was only a small company. So, you know, she was the kind of young, attractive girl in the marketing department, and I was the techie bloke in the other. our paths didn't cross very much. But it was around the time Facebook was becoming big. So Katie went off to do her thing. It was a small company, so we did see each other a reasonable amount socially and stuff. It was a very social little company. But we all kind of were friends on Facebook when the company kind of disappeared off into, I think, got bought out in the end. And that was that. You know what it's like. You've got friends on Facebook you've never ever spoken to, type thing. And it was a good 10 years. We went off our separate ways. We both had two daughters each, and lives and whatever, and then obviously that didn't work out for either of us. Katie was she was doing her dad was diagnosed unwell, and she was doing a sponsored walk up Kilimanjaro. And
I said, sponsored walk.
It was, it's a climb, sponsored climb.
It makes it sound like an amble around the village.
with a flask and a sandwich. Doing a climb up Kilimanjaro that she got fundraising for. And I saw a post she put up, and it just triggered me. I messaged her, and I just said, hey, Katie, how's things, kind of thing. And we got chatting, and, I was in Cotswolds area and she was in Devon, and over a period of time things moved on.
That's great, because you hear so many horror stories these days about Facebook. It's nice to hear something nice about it.
Facebook.
I think for, probably until Katie moved up to this area, I think for about 6 months we were a very high proportion of Facebook messengers.
So when you got together, you obviously both still had the desire to farm. So tell us about how Heritage Graziers started.
Well, Katie turned up with sheep for starters.
when I left sort of Devon and Cornwall area, I literally had my girls and I had my trailer of sheep and some possessions. That's sort of it, really.
Yeah.
And it was very much I was off to sort of start this new venture with the sheep, and to move up to the Cotswolds to be near James as well, because obviously we weren't going to have a future. It's like 3 hours apart, so it was coming back up really for that. And I signed on to a course, A level in textile design, because I had no textile skills whatsoever. I couldn't sew, couldn't knit. I just knew that I wanted to work with the wool from the sheep. So at the time you'd still had the pigs, but you'd had to let go of the land they were on, or that was.
And so the pigs kind of came to a natural end.
But you'd always fancied cows.
Yeah. I couldn't tell you why, but I kind of thought, well, pigs is good fun. I'd like to do pigs again, but actually I kind of want to have cows. And someone offered me a herd of Dexters. And I'd probably been, in spare minutes messaging a few people, sending emails around. They offered me a herd of Dexters, which I turned down because I didn't want Dexters. Mm-hmm. But I said, one of the reasons I gave for them is I've got no grass. I don't own any grass. And he said, oh, no, so they come with grass. And I went, oh, okay, how's that work then? And he said, well, they're conservation graze and you get paid to do it. So these, the small herd of Dexters was on, I think it was a water meadow towards Oxford somewhere. Okay. This guy was, they were conservation grazing. He was getting paid, an awful lot of money to graze them there. I think it was for a wildlife trust or a conservation organization of some form. And so I didn't buy the cows, but I went, well, okay, so what's this conservation grazing thing? And I kind of went to the National Trust and the Rare Breed Survival Trust were doing I think it was a weekend or two weekend course on doing that. And I went to that, had a look at it. And then I went and approached the Wildlife Trust. I mean, so Katie turned up and I think it was something like 13 sheep or something she'd had. And we needed grass from that. And that was relatively easy to do, to kind of rent some grass somewhere. But obviously for cows, you need a bit more. And we wanted kind of more than just one cow wandering around a field. It started to grow. So we approached the Gloucestershire Wildlife Trust, see if they had any reserves that they wanted conservation grazing. And with one of their managers there, they had a reserve they wanted grazing. We talked about stocking numbers and we went and bought some cows. And I think it was seven or eight cows we bought originally. Four cows with calves at foot, and they'd been to the bull. And then there were two heifers and a steer. So that's what? It's 11 cows, isn't it? That's it. We went down and picked them up, and I think we got them over a 6-9 month period. And we started, and that first year, the objective for the first year for the cows was to keep them alive. That really was our objective. It's not, people talk about learning curves and things like that. It was a learning cliff. Yeah. I was very lucky. My cousin, Charlie, one of the most passionate people I've ever met about any job for that matter. And I remember I sat on the phone to him one evening, probably for 3 hours. Saying, so cows then, how does that work? And he went through everything, all the daft stuff, the silly basics, when do you put the bull in, what's the gestation period for a cow? I didn't know. And so we went through in that 3-hour period actually the basics of this is what you need to know to get started. And we went from there. We've got a very good vet in Cirencester. There's a guy, well, all the vets at, in the practice are very good, but there's one, Rob, who's Benson Babb in Cirencester, has been very helpful, very understanding, and with his help and support, with general support off YouTube and various other places on the internet, that's how we got started, really. And we ended up growing from there, and trying to get more land. We graze for private landowners who have. There's a few landowners in the Cotswolds who've got a very kind of species rich grassland. So yep. Plow meadows, and some of them are incredible. You can walk. There's one I walked this summer. I walked probably 10 meters and I walked over 100 orchids. Wow. They are stunning. But these guys have got 10 hectares or so of this grassland, and obviously they own it. They don't own livestock, and it needs managing. So we go on and graze around those sites, which means moving the livestock and moving all the handling equipment with it. And over a period of 4 years or so, we've now built up to 23 cows. So we've got rare breed British white cows. And there are 65-ish. I always find it difficult to count the sheep. We'd never get the same one twice. 65 rare breed Portland and Castle McMorrock sheep. Now, I was going to say, we kind of got to that level because that's all the grass we had, because we didn't own anything. We didn't even own a house at the time. So that's all the grass we had. And that's what curtailed the numbers, really.
Certainly the cattle numbers.
Certainly the cows, yeah. I mean, the sheep quietly kept growing while I wasn't watching. we divvy up the work. So Katie, the sheep and the wool and everything for that, and I'm the cows. So it helps us not kind of drop a ball between, actually, well, I thought you were making sure that the sheep were getting shorn type thing.
So I guess
with farming like that, logistics, as you say, moving around, moving livestock, moving handling equipment, that must be the biggest challenge, is it?
It's not a challenge, it's a killer. it's such hard work. We were counting up sites yesterday, weren't we? Going over them. And I think James said on average we graze 8 different sites a year. Over the last year, I'd say, particularly with the move to Bruin, it's probably we're at 10. I'd say so. We've been at 10 different sites. And it's not like they're not like half a mile down the road. You know, you can't open a gate and move them on those different sites. You've got to relocate everything there and relocate all the handling equipment. And you know, we don't have like the sheep handling equipment. It's not a fancy mobile wrapper that can just all be compressed up onto a trailer and hooked on. I've got 30 individual mismatched sheep hurdles that need stacking and rolls of mesh,
pilot
post, a lot of baler twine. Do you know what I mean? And, you know, the cattle handling equipment's really big and heavy. And it's just the two of us. And because James has a full-time day job, we can't do it during the week. So historically that has started to change over the last few months, but historically it's all had to happen at the weekend. And we have 4 daughters who all do ballet or dance of some sort and who all have a social life. They're again, because of our family have being a blended family, they're not all at the same school. They're not all at the same dance school. In fact, their dance school is probably 40 minutes apart. So logistically, it's like managing an army. It's really challenging. You know, our diaries, you look at our diaries on the computer screen and you can't fit everything in on each day. It just rammed. And it is really, really, really hard work. It is really challenging. And sometimes it's, you know, really gets you down. And then other days it's like, no, this is our only choice. This is what we want to do. And this is the only way we can do that here.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the only way we could have livestock and have them on grass. And it is hard. I mean, particularly a lot of these conservation grazing sites that we do are not easy access. And I think the first one, for example, it was down a track, which you probably wouldn't take a car down, and it's quite steep. And at the bottom, there's not enough room to turn a trailer. So when we were taking down a trailer of handling equipment, you'd have to take the trailer down and then take it off and kind of try and manhandle it round to be able to come back out again. And and it's heavy, you know, particularly cattle handling. I mean, I remember the first time we don't use a crush because that's just not viable because everything's got to be moved by hand. So we had a yoke, and I hate to think how many hundreds of kilos this yoke weighs, but we had to manhandle it up a steep slope that was not the easiest to walk up, and we rolled it. And this is one of the yokes that the IAE yoke's got the kind of cage around the front. And we ended up manhandling this over a period of hours by rolling it up a steep hill by hand.
I mean, if we'd had a tractor, I don't know if you could have got a tractor onto that site, actually.
You got it on the site, but not where the handling equipment went, because of that steep slope. It was just not passable. And we've got better. We've now got better. So, you know, we don't use that particular yoke anymore. We've got a lighter one, and we do... You know, we have to be smart about it. So I use my engineering skills. So, you know, my physics teacher at school would be proud of me. I actually use some of the stuff he taught me. We've got a manual kind of pulley system where we can lift it. So we don't have, you know, standing a yoke up that's lying on the ground, you know, you've got to lift it to stand it vertical. You know, it's ridiculously heavy, and it's also dangerous as well. So we are smarter about it. Sure. But you know, moving between eight sites, it's we're nearly 2 tons of handling equipment that needs moving.
Yeah.
So it's hard work, which is why we charge for the conservation grazing, because you know it's usually poor access. We have to move the stock on and off.
Yeah.
And of course, it's not great grass either. So the condition of the stock suffers during the winter for it as well.
Can't feed over the winter.
Yeah, we can't supplementary feed on the sites we're on, so they do take a hit as well.
That's part of the agreement, is it, obviously?
Yeah, I mean, some of these sites are in HLS, where or stewardship scheme, which is, you know, no supplementary feeding. Sure. Most of the ones we graze actually aren't, but they are that high quality wildlife meadows that we treat them as though they were, so we don't supplementary feed. And you know, that's why we've got native stock. You know, the native stock are, you know, that's what they do. They survive quite happily. Manage that. And you know, when we had the snow last winter, you know, I've got photographs of the water trough, which probably has got 20-30 centimeters of snow, ice, sludge kind of thing on the top, and there's three holes that the cows have punched through it to get at the water. So they do survive quite happily on it, but they do take a knock on condition.
Okay. Now, from what you've told us about the way you're doing this, you do seem to want to farm in a very low impact and beneficial way to the environment. Is that something that you are very conscious of?
Yes. I think the short answer is because obviously we started with conservation grazing, that was what we had to do, but actually we've become quite passionate about it, I think.
Yeah.
And quite,
we've seen the impact and the benefits, the changes mm-hmm. in the meadows that we've been grazing in this way.
Yeah.
And that's the biggest reward, isn't it? I think,
yeah, it is.
You can actually see the benefit.
What we made a mistake the first year, and we didn't actually visit the wildflower meadows.
Sorry.
Hi, Jack.
Getting a bit.
He's still here, by the way.
Not bad for an hour, is it?
No.
But for the first year, we didn't actually visit the meadows in the summer. So all we saw was them in the winter under snow at times and cold, wet, and miserable. And the second year, we went and walked these wildflower meadows. And it was one of the best things I've ever done, because you know it has been hard work at times, it has been tough, but to see the results of how we were grazing those meadows, and to see, I mean, literally, you know, it's just humming with noise of insects and bees, and that was great. And you know, since then we've kind of got involved in the regenerative agricultural type stuff. I've been to Groundswell the last couple of years, and you know, we're looking at, you know, we've been to see a lot of other farmers that do the regenerative agriculture stuff. And there's been a few that are quite, almost inspirational, really. You know, in particular, Rob Hubbard, who is not too far from us, does a lot he does holistic planned grazing and holistic management. And, you know, seeing him be so passionate about what he does, about the kind of regeneration of the soil health, and he's got some wildflower meadows they work with there and things like that, but he turns profit on it as well. It's not just I'm doing this because I love the land and it's a hobby. He makes a proper profit from it and makes it a viable business. And to see people like that doing it, is that's the direction we're wanting to move in. And you know, we've, I think Katie mentioned the Bruin estate in passing earlier. We've got approached this year by an estate about half an hour away from here, wanting us to go and graze for them. And part of the deal for that will be doing things like regenerative grazing. So not probably mob grazing, because we won't move livestock every day, but the going down the route of, you know, letting grass grow longer, kind of grazing a third of it, half of it off, leaving the rest. You know, all the benefits that gives around soil health, carbon sequestering, water management there near a river. So it helps, it will help them hopefully kind of hold more water in the soil and things like that. So, yeah, it is something we are passionate about and we want to be doing. And it's part of the ethos. You know, we've got rare breed livestock. all these native breeds, the quality of the beef and the lamb, we're not aimed at kind of mass production, you know, feeding lots of people, making small profit on each individual animal. It's a premium product we're doing. And with that comes a story. And actually that fits well with, you know, as Katie's talked about her background in, you know, in history and to know where the food comes from, it all kind of fits in together. So the kind of farming with nature is something that, that really kind of hits home, I think, really.
Yeah, okay. And Katie, tell us more about Loopy Ewes. You mentioned it briefly before, but tell us a bit more about it.
Yeah, so when I bought my first sheep, it was obviously to produce lamb, but also I'd seen a lot about wool not being particularly a valued resource for farmers. And I wanted that to be better, I guess. It's incredible, these every year that sheep produce this whole new fleece whilst, rearing young. And it's just this incredible sustainable fibre that we have enormous access to. And the fact that there were farmers out there but burning fleeces, burying fleeces, because it just wasn't worth the, well, they were just making a loss on it. Yeah. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't worth spending the time rolling, cleaning out, picking out the fleeces to send them off to the marketing board for the money that they would get, that just would not cover the time they'd spent doing that, plus the shearing fee. You know, I totally get why it's not worth it.
Yeah.
But I just didn't believe that it had to be that way. And so I wanted to do something different. I wanted to do it differently. And I think because, although I didn't have any textile skills at all, because I had a design background, I felt relatively competent that I would be able to design products from with the wool. So that's what I set about doing. At the time, I was obviously based in Cornwall, so I was near the Natural Fibre Company, which is quite a well-known small mill that small producers can go to get their fleeces processed. Mm-hmm. There's still a minimum of 25 kilograms of fleeces. You can't just turn up with like five fleeces. So I had to keep the first couple of years fleeces. I built them up till I had enough to take in to get my first batch of yarns done.
Sure.
But it was amazing. At the time, when I first thought about the idea, I was going to pay like local people to hand knit products for me.
Okay.
Because I knew I couldn't knit, and there was no way I was ever going to be a knit quick enough to make it viable in any way at all. And I had one of my best friends was over for dinner, and she was staying with me for the weekend. We were all sat for dinner. She said, "Why don't you use a knitting machine?" I said, "What's a knitting machine?" She said, "Oh, my mum, or it was her gran or her mum had one. It was great. She used to sit there and she used to bash out all this knitting." And, oh, I've never even heard of that. So had a look on the internet and found someone that was doing a course in Herefordshire. So I went on this course in Herefordshire and learned how to use a knitting machine. And it's great. I love it. And it's a way for me to produce very quickly, panels of knitting, which I can then, make products from.
What kind of things do you make?
So the focus is on, I'm not really a fashion person. I'm more into homes. I love interior design and interiors and homes and things like that. So my focus is on homewares, like cushions, hot water bottle covers, cafetiere cozies, blankets, things like that, sheepskin rugs. And also I think my wool is better suited for that as well. I do make a scarf, a really beautiful scarf. Obviously I'm totally biased, but I do make a scarf. And I'm a bit funny about wool, about, you know, I can find it itchy on my skin. I've got sensitive to wool. But I'm comfortable wearing one of the scarves. And I made one for a marketing ploy to put round one of my tups to get a photo of my tup going into the field, like rocking a loopy youth scarf. And actually, I thought, well, now I've made the scarf, I'm gonna wear it. Yeah. And I wore it, and I was like, oh, actually, this is quite comfortable. This is quite nice. Quite like this. So I then designed a scarf to sell, which has been really popular.
Wow,
I shipped two out to America like 2 weeks ago, which is amazing, you know.
And, so you've and got I'm a thinking, website. You've got a website then, so people. Can
yeah, I've got a website, loopyuse.co.uk, and most of my sales come through the website.
That's awesome.
It's an amazing journey to watch the fleece grow throughout the year outdoors. See it come off at shearing, take it down to the mill in Cornwall and watch it be made into this beautiful yarn. And then I can sit at the knitting machine and work with it and turn it into an end product. And I think having that cycle and with the product is incredible. It's incredible to be a part of. And I think people really value that when they're buying it. They value the provenance and the story and the care that's gone into it. And, you know, something that, you know, I really love about it is pulling together all these fantastic rural businesses. So, you know, there's obviously me, the shepherd, there's the shearer, there's the mill, the rural, small rural mill. You know, with the blankets I had made, I used a hand weaver up on Dartmoor. So it's all woven by hand, not on machines. You know, my sheepskin rugs, I've had processed it at two places, but one of them is the Skye Skins on the Isle of Skye. You know, and we visited the tannery when we were on holiday in Skye, so they get shipped up to this fantastic, it doesn't get more rural than the far end of the Isle of Skye, where they're tanning these sheepskins for me. And I love that all the products are sort of coming from all corners of the British Isles. I think that's fantastic. And I think people, not everyone can afford to make that choice, but I think everybody, you know, the people that do buy it really value the product that they're buying. And that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to make something with real provenance, with real sustainability in it.
There's mentioning sustainable. There's obviously a lot of talk about sustainable fabric lately, with a lot of focus on microfibers in the ocean. Do you think there's going to be a more increased focus on wool again in the coming years, or is it a bit of a misunderstood product?
I think so. We're always going to have this difficulty, I think, with people that are uncomfortable about wool on their skin, and I think there needs to be a realistic attitude that there is a percentage of British wool that it isn't going to be making fine garments, mm-hmm. but there are so many incredible innovative ways of working with wool, and I think there's also ways of blending different fibers to make that difference as well. So I do believe that will play a bigger role for sure in our future. I think, you know, I think there's an awful lot of realization about all these rubbish decisions that we've been making and the impact that that's having on our environment, and that there is a need for change. I think there's still people that are, you know, there's a lot of people that say there needs to be change. The difference in the people that are then prepared to put their money where their mouth is and shop differently, it's a big gap. Mm-hmm. And I think until shops or the government, and until the government forces the change, I think it's going to be very slow.
Yeah.
And I don't believe it's going to come from big corporates, you know, not really. I mean, we are seeing change. That's not fair. You know, we are seeing bigger companies make smarter decisions, but some of it still feels quite a shallow level because it's important, good PR. I think that it's so fundamental, the change that's got to be made. I think, and it's going to cost a lot of money. It's going to cost businesses money. I think it's going to have to be forced to a degree by government.
Yeah.
And that's a scary thing to do, isn't it? Because if you annoy businesses as a government, that's your people that vote you in and pay their taxes. And so it's hard. It's really tough. It's a tough situation.
It's all the momentum behind the plastic stuff, which have a lot of public awareness and momentum. I hope that will drive it.
Definitely.
And there are things, carpets is a good example.
Yeah.
Wool's great on carpets. Well, there's a lot of wool kicking around. Why aren't we using that rather than, the man-made fibres that are in the majority of carpets? So
I saw something on social media the other day that someone went to buy some new carpet, and the guy in the shop was actually pushing them to buy synthetic carpet. Okay. And she was like, no, I want the British wool carpet. And he was pushing the synthetic carpet on her. Mm. And it's just going to take a long time. If it's left to the individual, I think it does need some.
Needs a push, doesn't it?
It does need a push, yeah. I mean, it's, it's totally, you look at where we are now compared to where we were 5 years ago, and it's totally different. It's definitely gaining momentum all over the world, and I think people are more ready for the change than they were. I really think British wool definitely has an important role to play. And what I tell you what frustrates me as well, I don't think the price of fleeces has to go up that exponentially for it actually to be of value to farmers. I don't know what the going rate is for fleeces. Is it like £1.50 a fleece people get?
Something like that.
Even if it doubled, even if it went to like £3 a fleece, that would make such a difference. Such a difference, wouldn't it?
I think
that extra £1.50. I think about the profit that the companies will be making that are potentially using the fleeces, I think I can't believe that £1.50 can't get handed down the supply chain to the farmer.
No, I agree. Guys, right, we're going to have to wrap this up with the hard-hitting quick questions because I don't want to keep you and Jack any longer. he's been very patient there, hasn't he?
Yeah, he's a good boy. He's still having to be fair on his baby gym, but yeah.
So what are your all-time favourite songs? James, do you want to go first?
Well, I'm glad you've asked this individually because we couldn't agree on one for both. I have an eclectic music taste, to say the least. So I kind of like the song you can belt out. So things like Elton John and Rock Man and Your Song and Queen and... Adele, Something Like You is a song I love because we sing it to the kids in the car, full volume, and I love that. The one I kind of settled on, I think it's an old one, it's a classic one, but it just gets me every time, is Hey Jude by the Beatles.
Yeah, belter. Great choice. What about you, Katie?
Probably something by ABBA, like Waterloo maybe, because I really love an upbeat song, and I think if you know most of the words, you can't help but sing and dance around the kitchen. And I love that's one of the things I love about ABBA, is I know most of the words to most of the songs, and it just lifts you up and gets you dancing and having a good old sing song.
We get a lot of ABBA played in the house because the girls are all big fans of Mamma Mia, the musical.
Once you have kids, your taste in music changes.
It really does.
I know, you're the cool parent. I'm not.
All right. What one thing do you both wish you had more time for?
Well, I put each other. We don't have a lot of time for each other.
Yeah.
And I think we're at the mid. We're at the centre of all of this and the glue that holds it together. And I think we need to do a better job of making time for each other. It's difficult.
Without
a doubt, it's a really obvious one. It's just to stop and spend more time together. Depending how much time, if I was allowed to be a bit extravagant with my extra time, I have a habit of collecting books that I never read.
Yeah.
I have a shelf of books about grass and cattle and kind of all that sort of stuff, which I've never read. And I'd love to read because I love to learn, and I'd love to get better at what we do on that side of things. So I'd do that. The other thing I do, if you've got loads of spare time, is I tinker. So I built a full scale kind of clay oven a number of years ago, which kind of disappeared with the house when the house went. And I do things like that. I build a clay oven, an Argentinian barbecue. Tinker around and make bits of software. I just tinker because I'm not very good at actually stopping. I mean, really, time together, that would definitely, I think we'd both agree on that one.
Yeah, okay. What's the number one place that you'd both like to visit?
Do we have to go together? Are we allowed different places?
You could go separately if you want to.
So we did agree on somewhere, yeah.
Yeah, I always said that I'd go back to the South Island, New Zealand. That's not the place we'd go. I still need to do that because I never made it, because I worked for 3 months when I was in New Zealand. And it was a great experience, but I'd missed going to South Island. Where we would go is we'd go to Patagonia.
Great choice.
I'd love to go to Patagonia.
Both, as you can gather, love the outdoors. We've done a lot of kind of hill walking and things like that. And we also sea kayak as well if we ever get spare time. And so we'd kind of do some walking, go and see Patagonia and do a bit of sea kayaking around Patagonia.
Brilliant. Big Welsh-speaking community out there as well.
There is.
Look at that, yeah. Okay, then. You're both hosting a dinner party. You can have four guests from history, living or dead. Who are you having?
Again, we've chosen two each because Katie doesn't necessarily agree with my decision. first one is I'd have Freddie Mercury, but he'd have to be in a singing mood.
That's a really good choice.
I think he'd be a really interesting person.
Yeah,
also,
definitely.
I never saw him in concert. I never saw him sing. And I'd love to have done that. I think, he captivates an audience. And so that's a bit of a random one.
Yeah. I agree with that one though, definitely.
The other one, which I have, which is probably even more random, is Leonardo da Vinci.
I can see why you would have chosen him though.
The thing I love about him, he was obviously an amazing artist, Last Supper, Mona Lisa and all that sort of stuff, the Puritan man, that was him, that man of drawing with the arms out and doing proportions and stuff. But he was also so into kind of the scientific medical studies and drawings and engineering as well. One of the first helicopters and things like that. So to actually talk to someone, it's a really rare balance to get someone who is engineeringly, brilliant, but also artistic.
Definitely.
Something you see very often. So I think he'd be a fascinating person. I'm not sure how well he'd get on with Freddie Mercury, but
I reckon they'd get on okay.
Those are my two.
So I said Prince Charles, actually. I'd really love to have a good old chat with Prince Charles, all about organic farming and British wool and things like that. I think he'd be really interesting to talk to. That would be on my list. And the other person that I'd put is my dad, actually. Whether it would be, I don't get to see him very often and he's not very well. So it would either be hit him now or possibly from when he was younger.
Yeah.
Like back in time and sort of to meet him when he was, maybe in his 20s or 30s and sort of at the maybe around the time he met my mum, maybe.
Yeah.
I'd go for something like that, really.
I suspect he was quite a fun character.
He is an absolute character. He's not very well, and that has an impact on you. But I think it would be my dad in some form or other. He would definitely have got on with Freddie Mercury. He has to get on with everybody at that dinner table, I think.
All right, then. Lastly, what are your favourite agriculture-related social media accounts to follow?
So on Facebook, I follow Badinskill Farm on Facebook, and their posts on Facebook are really fantastic. So they're a hill farm in the Scottish Borders, and they've got about 1,400 Scottish black-faced sheep and a fold of Highland cattle. And the shepherd there that manages the livestock is that she's a single mum, she's got a young child, and she's an ex-vet. And she regularly posts on Facebook, and most incredible photos. So she's obviously got a good camera and is good at taking photos, but she also puts really detailed posts up that are, about what they're doing and why they're doing it. And I think whether you're a farmer or whether you're Joe Public, you can learn something from what they're sharing. So absolutely would recommend Badinskill Farm on Facebook.
Okay, great choice. Okay, what about you, James?
Oh, I probably agree with that. I mean, there's a number of organisations, like social media accounts that we follow. I think people like Agricology, FWAG, Southwest FWAG, we go to quite a few of their farm walks, and they've got a massive amount of information. It's a great network to share. Nature Friendly Farming Network is a fairly obvious one for us. Yeah. I think I agree with Katie. I think they kind of hit across the board, that, and I think anyone would get something from the Facebook posts they put up. So we'll agree on that one.
There you go. Okay, guys, it's been great to speak to you both. Best of luck for the future with what you're doing there. I think it's genuinely quite inspirational, I think. And hopefully catch you both soon.
Great. Thank you, Will.
And thanks to Jack for being so good and well behaved. It's much better than my kids.
Yeah, we haven't got the others here. If we had the others here, it'd be chaos. Fall asleep, I suspect, still.
And to everyone at home, thanks for listening, and I hope to see you next time. I've been Will Evans. This has been Rock and Roll Farming. Thank you, and good night.